I think this is not an easy topic, the thought experiment that both Patrick and Michael just took us through, to try to imagine not only the world as it is today, but what the context would be like as we think about the months ahead and how the international community and Iran joust with each other and what the situation will be possibly at a moment when a decision on prevention is taken. I'd like to open the floor now to your comments and questions about this topic. Anything from today's headlines to the more theoretical. First Dan and then here Scott.
If you could there are microphones.
Here's the desk
in front of you. And if you could please identify yourself.
Hi. Nice presentation. I enjoyed reading this study as well a few weeks ago. My question is, in dealing with Iran, and Michael, you said there at the end, you know, we must redouble our diplomatic efforts to deal with the government of Iran, to deter the government, or I'm sure you've also considered and discussed briefly, what about redoubling efforts to change Iran, whether to cause what they'd call, you know, trigger a counter-revolution, help the students, help the workers, etc., that would be maybe even a better bet and with a very intense effort might succeed?
My preference at this point is that we focus on a diplomatic route that focuses on both a combination of carrots and sticks. You had Javier Solana presenting in Tehran this last weekend a package of incentives, which I think, you know, having read them, I think certainly, you know, I think a reasonable person could conclude should form the basis for, you know, additional discussions. But I think we also have to have stronger sticks than we've had thus far. And I have to say one thing that's, you know, just personally a source of frustration is the lack of what I perceive to be a lack of alacrity on the part of many of our allies in Europe, in the Arab world, in Russia and China, for devoting the seriousness to the problem that I think it deserves. I mean, we've got a lot of, you know, hectoring of, you know, warmongers in the U.S., but we don't see a lot of action to take diplomatic steps that could avert such an outcome. So to be honest with you, my preference would be to focus right now. You know, I think the conclusion among people who look at the issue of regime change is that it's not likely to happen anytime soon. We don't have a good track record of predicting these kind of things, and therefore the main focus should be on near-term diplomacy. But I suspect Patrick might have some thoughts on this as well.
I think it's no secret that the Bush administration, I suspect the vast majority of the American people, would be very delighted if we woke up tomorrow morning and discovered that the Islamic Republic no longer existed. And the Iranian leaders are fully aware of that. And so therefore, any renunciation on our part of policy of pursuing regime change is going to be regarded as hypocritical and inaccurate. Furthermore, we have a supreme leader in Iran who has, for the last 20 years, insisted that the great danger to his country is cultural invasion, not military invasion, who fears Hollywood, not Washington, and who throws 67-year-old grandmothers in jail for months because of the concern that George Soros and George Bush are conspiring together to bring about an overthrow of the Iranian regime. Given that he is firmly, the supreme leader, is firmly convinced of the risk of a velvet revolution, who's firmly convinced that his regime is vulnerable, the way the East European regimes were vulnerable, and whose reading of the events of 1979 to 1999, as he frequently explains, is that the Iranian people would love to reject the Islamic Republic if they had an opportunity to do so. That's what he sees Khatami's election and the student demonstrations that brought more than a million people onto the streets in 1999, and which did lead to some questions to whether or not the regime was going to survive. So given his preoccupation, his conviction that his regime is vulnerable to this kind of cultural invasion and to this overthrow through Velvet Revolution, it's very unlikely that we're going to persuade him that we are not pursuing a policy of regime change. Now, all of this makes it really tough to come up with a policy of deterrence for Iran. Because deterrence requires not only drawing a red line which says if you step over this red line, you're in big trouble, but saying that if you stay on the correct side of the red line, you're okay. Khamenei doesn't believe that. And from his perspective, he's right. Because we're not going to stop Hollywood from making movies that he thinks undermines the stability of his regime. I mean, I hate to plug a colleague's or a competitor's work, but Karim Sajidpour at the Carnegie Endowment, in his study about reading Khamenei, has wonderful quotes and brilliant analysis about this is a man who worries more about miniskirts than tanks. He has a quote from him saying that. And so how the heck we're going to be able to establish confidence in his mind that he's okay if he doesn't pursue a nuclear program, that's going to be really tough.
I can see the title of our next product will be Miniskirts for Mullahs. Scott Delman, can you please use the mic in the middle of the table?
Sure. That's okay. Scott Delman. Thank you. Scott Delman, a trustee, Washington Institute. I was struck by your comments about the importance of being able to carry out what I'll term post-strike diplomacy, and therefore how unlikely it is, in your view, that given the time frame that is available to the Bush administration, that in fact we're going to see this current administration launch such preventive action. That, however, then raises a significant question about timing, because irrespective of which candidate wins in November of 2008, you would have to assume that that new administration is going to take time to formulate its strategy, is going to take time to try to approach Iran on some new policy of engagement. And so at that juncture, we're probably well into 2010 until a new administration reaches the conclusion that it, in fact, has exhausted its diplomatic alternatives. So my two questions are, first, whether you agree with the assumptions and analysis on such timing. And this is obviously absent some sort of Iranian breakthrough announcement. The second is whether or not it is realistic to expect the Israelis to sit still for, we're talking about a further 24 months at a time when you have senior members of that government ratcheting up their verbal warnings and therefore risking their own policy of deterrence if they fail to act.
A frequent message in the middle of the Washington Institute to senior administration officials is you may wish to ignore the Middle East, but the Middle East may not ignore you. And I would just suggest that the history of the last few decades has been U.S. presidents finding themselves faced with situations in the Middle East that require urgent attention on their part when they had not expected it and not wanted it. And I would not in the least be surprised if what drives the timetable on decisions about Iran are Iranian actions. For instance, we are coming up on the 30th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution next February. Iran has a long history of wanting to do dramatic things for these sorts of anniversaries. It will be an interesting moment. I would just suggest that a major theme of our analysis about context has been that the Iranians are in many ways driving this process forward as much as anybody else. And so before we conclude that what Bush might do before he leaves office or how long a new administration would take to tackle this problem, we have to consider what is Iran going to be doing. And let me just point out that when the Clinton administration came into office, it turned its attention very quickly to the to the problem of the former Yugoslavia and Bosnia. It also changed its mind very quickly about what it was going to do from what it said it was going to do when it was in campaign, and did something quite different. So there are certainly precedents for administrations concentrating their effort on their attention very quickly on a problem, and precedent for them doing things which were quite different from what they had said they would do during the campaign.
If I can use the mic here. Just on this question, I mean, though personally I'm skeptical that the administration will, you know, go the kind of, you know, parting shot kind of, you know, model. You know, who knows? I mean, because, I mean, they might, you know, say that, well, you know, pointing to the OSIREC model, that you know, maybe it'd be desirable to have a policy that was sustainable, but maybe the parting shot, it's not a choice between a policy that's sustainable and one shot, but it's one shot and no policy on prevention. So it's possible they might act before they leave office again, though I tend to be skeptical on that. In terms of the next administration, it usually takes several months, as you say, for them to get seated. Some people have said, well, you know, if you're going to strike, don't strike before the presidential elections, because that'll ensure an Ahmadinejad victory.
The May 2009.
Yeah, the Iranian presidential elections. And others say, well, the president really is not the key guy anyhow. It's Khamenei, so maybe that shouldn't be a consideration. Again, those are, I think, the American considerations. And then finally, I think in any new administration, no matter who gets elected, I think there will be a very strong temptation to try the diplomatic route before trying other routes, even you know, whether it's McCain or Obama, I think, because you could always go the kinetic route at the end of the day, but, you know, try diplomacy first, especially if there is a new president. Although, again, maybe some people, you know, again, there's a debate whether how important really the presidency is. So it's a complicated brew. The bottom line is, as you said, though, the Israelis are not constrained by these considerations. And, you know, this is a classic case of where you stand depends upon where you sit. And things look very different from there than they do here. Who's to say? I don't know.
Just on this point, if you have the time, what I would suggest is you read Chuck Freilich's discussion of how the United States and Israel would talk to each other about this issue together with this paper, because, I'm sorry?
Or would not talk to each other on
this issue, because as Chuck points out in his paper called Speaking the Unspeakable, that there are many aspects of this topic which even the best of friends are reluctant to talk about with each other. What Patrick and Mike's paper does not go into, for example, is, you know, what would America's reaction be if the Israelis came to the United States and said, you know, time's up, we're you know, we need to, now or never, you need to act, you know. That's a different discussion. Patrick and Mike's discussion is a more general systemic discussion of the issue. So if you read the two papers together, I think you get a better sense of an integrated understanding of how this issue would play out in practice. Ed Ludwig.
Right. We heard two admirable presentations of the complexities and costs and risks of action and inaction. And I'm puzzled by the contrast between these very comprehensive presentations and the fact that the United States and other actors have not taken very simple, low-cost, elementary measures. For example, the Japanese government has stopped investing in Iranian oil. Japanese car companies don't sell 4x4s in Iran. Well, the Koreans, the Lucky Group, LG Group, has a security company in Iran that sells encrypted communications to the Iranians. And at the same time, they sell refrigerators and cell phones in this country. And nobody has ever thought of that. Doosan Corporation of Korea provides heavy engineering support for boilers and power stations and, I dare say, other things in Iran. And they sell in this country. And nobody has ever raised the issue. In other words, yes, we've had financial very active, treasury has been very active, but I mean there are many gaps about things that could be done which are of infinitely lower cost and complexity than the measures that were there. The other thing that I find puzzling is that the United States does have a Wilsonian tradition, and in Iran there is a Baluch insurgency underway, which is quite an active insurgency. There is a Kurdish insurgency, there's an Arab insurgency, and there is Turk agitation. They call them Azeris, but they're Turks. The United States, as far as I know, perhaps, has done nothing whatsoever to give them aid and comfort nobody else has, and these are national movements and so on. The final point is, in terms of the Iranian political context, I have heard Iranian leaders keep saying in the last couple of years and with the rising crescendo that nobody would dare to attack us. Nobody would dare to attack us. Now, surely, they keep saying it very emphatically, and that represents some kind of commitment. If somebody does attack them, there might be political consequences for them.
On your first point, I'm putting on my economist hat, the United States has benefited greatly by the expansion of world trade, and we have benefited greatly by the fact that that many people around the world purchase U.S. products even though they dislike the policies of the United States government. And the depoliticization of trade has been an important objective of the United States over the years, constructing an international system in which trading in goods is separate from what one thinks about the policy of the government that where the goods were produced. And so we would be ill-served by putting that at risk without good cause. Now, I think that there is a lot of reason to be concerned about the sale of dual-use goods to Iran, and that the United Nations sanctions, which are often described inaccurately as being symbolic, are in fact really quite tough, often calling for restrictions upon selling things for Iran's nuclear and missile programs. I would love to see that extended to more areas of Iran's military and security, and I would also like to see much more effort made to get other countries around the world to enforce these rules, and for that matter, to see the United States enforce these rules. Indeed, later on this summer, we're having the Undersecretary of Commerce for Export Administration speaking here, and he's been interested in trying to use some of the same kinds of techniques that the Treasury Department has used in order to persuade companies around the world that they're putting their reputations at risk if their products are found in Iran's nuclear or missile programs, or for that matter, indeed, in other nefarious programs like terrorist support. So I think more can be done.
Terrific pressure on Japan.
Well, look.
And not of Korea because of simple inadvertence.
One problem has been so long as what we have to rely upon is the United States is jawboning, that may not be as effective as Security Council resolutions. It demonstrates the usefulness of broad international support for what we're doing. I think I'm going to leave the other parts to Michael.
Yeah, just with regard to Iranian confidence that the United States is going to strike. I mean, I actually you hear different things. I mean, because, Ahmadinejad has been very kind of adamant or forceful in his public statements that, the Islamic Republic doesn't have to worry about an American attack. And on the other hand, there have been rejoinders recently. I think Rafsanjani and I think the Supreme Leader even have cautioned him that, let's be careful because, we don't know. I've long believed that Ahmadinejad might, for domestic political reasons, even welcome a limited military strike. Again, limited. As a way of kind of, he's one who looks back to, the days of the imposed war, the Iran-Iraq war as, Iran's finest moment. And, a time when the country was still imbued with revolutionary fervor. And so he might welcome a limited strike in order to help kind of revive that kind of the values of the revolution and the like. I suspect there are other people within the regime who feel otherwise. So, and let me just say, again, I think that's probably a limited military strike, something that would really get far-reaching destruction to Iran's infrastructure could be a political liability for him. So it's a very complex calculus, and the bottom line is the fact that they're having this discussion, I think, is useful, and I think it's, it can't be proven, but I think it's because there is this perception that prevention is on the table. And that's why I think it needs to be kept on the table, you know, for diplomatic purposes at the very least. Thank you.
Peter and then Dana.
Thank you, Bob. This question is for Michael and Pat. You can answer it. Just an advertisement. Roger Robinson's organization, Conflict Securities, and Frank Gaffney's Center for Security Policy have been pushing a full-scale divestment campaign from Iran, including companies that do business in our country that aren't American. And so, Eddie, a very good point, and it's something we should do, which I think it would have an enormous effect. My question, Michael, is this. Put your Persian-Iranian hat on and sit down with the Supreme Leader and tell us what is the deal that he would accept with the Europeans, the United States, and the Security Council, and would it include giving up not only the nukes, which of course is the issue, either telling us one way or the other, but what about the support of terrorism? What about the ballistic missile programs? What I've never heard from the Iranian side, and those people who say, well, just give diplomacy a chance, is where's the deal, and what is it?
I mean, this gets into the debate of whether there should be a grand bargain or a more limited deal. I mean, the whole problem with the grand bargain is that there's so many moving parts, you know, it makes it just much more complicated and difficult. I'm just, you know, not sure that's doable at this point, even though it has a certain appeal. You know, on the basic contours for a deal, look, I mean, the United States has kind of moved on this issue in the last few years. We used to be categorically opposed to Boucher, and we've come around to the position now that we're willing to accept, peaceful civilian nuclear energy program in Iran, but one that does not involve both, you know, the front end and rear end of the fuel cycle, that is enrichment or separation capabilities. So I think that would be, I mean, that's basically the contours. I mean, if you look at the paper that was handed by Solana to the Iranians, you know, over the weekend, it basically calls for, you know, international assistance in the nuclear arena. My preference would be also to focus a lot of the assistance on developing other aspects of Iran's energy sector. You know, they have large water resources and maybe geothermal. So anyhow, that's, you know, I don't know if Pat has some additional points you'd like to make on this.
Yeah. Two comments, one on the deal. One of Iran's senior diplomats, not now in power, once said that Iran excels at doing a deal at the 90th minute. When it could have gotten a great deal at the 59th minute, they instead play the game out longer and then end up getting a great deal less than they would have gotten earlier. And so I would not be surprised that if at the end of the day Iran decides on a deal, we are all surprised the contours of it. I just suggest that we held a conference here in early September 2003 about Iran's nuclear program, and not a single person attending that event thought that there was any possibility whatsoever that Iran would ever agree to suspend its enrichment and conversion, which it did the next month. So that would be one comment. And the second comment is on the question of trade. I neglected to mention that Senator McCain called for in his APAC speech, and I gather that Senator Obama has now endorsed, the idea of a voluntary boycott of the sale of gasoline to Iran. And it's a very limited number of companies which are selling gasoline to Iran. The two largest suppliers of gasoline to Iran both dropped out of the business, saying that it was too complicated to deal with all of the restrictions placed on the transactions because of the U.S. financing rules, and that Iran depends upon gasoline for a large portion, approximately half of its gasoline use. I get very different readings as to how practical this idea would be, including very different readings from people in the oil business, how practical this idea would be. But certainly if we are already in a situation where the Iranian driver who is waiting in line at the pump for his gasoline and complaining about the rationing and the much higher price he has to pay for non-rationed gas already blames the nuclear program for this, because that was the rationale the Iranian government used in introducing rationing, was to say that we had to ration because of the risk of international pressure against our gasoline imports. And if we can get in a situation where the Iranian people are grumbling that the nuclear program is not worth the effort, that's good.
Damn it.
Thanks very much for that presentation. In the interest of full disclosure, I've not read the paper, but I certainly will. And it's possible that you, probably likely that you are talking about this, the questions I'm going to ask in the paper. But I was going to ask you to sort of draw you out a little bit on deterrence. And it's the sort of related things. One is, the way I look at it, you know, there are people that do not believe that the Iranian state can be deterred. Certainly, in my mind, it's easier to deter the Iranian state than to possibly deter those who might seek to obtain one of these weapons, either buying, stealing, or perhaps even being given by rogue elements in the state that are not part of the Iranian state. So it seems that ultimately the value of deterrence is how good of a lock, so to speak, there is on the vaults that would contain these weapons. The other question, and I wonder what your comments are on that one, because that clearly is a very different situation than we had in the old Soviet Union and the other countries that we are still deterring against. The other question is, what about the nuclear forensics issue? God forbid a bomb goes off, no return address. What does deterrence mean in a case like that? We didn't do it, nobody did it, nobody takes claim for it, and the damage is done. I wonder if you could comment, or whether that's in the paper.
On the forensics, I don't know. I hear very different things from different people. We do not have experience, so it's not clear to me that, in fact, we have a very good idea what the answer is to the question. As technical people put it to me, one problem is that if there's an explosion, a lot of stuff gets destroyed. A lot harder to determine what was there before the explosion. I'll leave the first question to you. Let me make a comment about the deterrence question, which is to say that a lot of what we want to deter is the breakdown of the nonproliferation system. There is a reason why the people who are working on this problem in each of the great powers is an expert on proliferation and not an expert on Iran. The fundamental reason that the French government is so tough on this issue is not because they are concerned about the threat that Iran represents to the security of the state of Israel. It's not the highest priority for France. What they are very worried about, and what is the highest priority for France, is keeping the world from going to a situation where there are dozens of nuclear-armed countries. So it is nuclear proliferation, a nuclear arms race around the world, which is the fundamental issue concentrating the minds of the great powers, and not a revolutionary regime in Iran. The revolutionary regime in Iran certainly makes the case all the more urgent, but the fundamental question here is, can we hold together a non-proliferation regime in the aftermath of a nuclear Iran? Again, I hate to plug somebody else, but yesterday I was at the International Institute of Strategic Studies and the unveiling of their new study on nuclear programs in the Middle East and the shadow of Iran. And here's a very sober group of European experts who say that there would be a proliferation cascade if Iran is able to proceed much further down this route. That is the great problem we have to deter. And any discussion about deterrence and the Iranian nuclear program has to focus on that question. It's not just a matter of how do we deter Iran. It's how do we deter Saudi Arabia. It's how do we deter Egypt. It's how do we deter Algeria. And for that matter, how do we deter South Africa, Argentina, and Brazil, Taiwan, Japan, South Korea. I could keep going. So when you think about deterrence in the face of an Iranian nuclear breakout, first words that should come to your mind is nuclear arms race, and not mad mullahs.
Yeah, on this particular issue of the challenges of deterrence, this is something which I've spent a lot of time writing about in previous publications. In particular, I had an Adelphi paper in, an article in Survival in 1999, Living with a Nuclear Iran, and then an article in this Army War College publication that Patrick co-edited called Getting Ready for a Nuclear Ready Iran. And basically, I mean, my take on this is that it's not a matter of, you know, the putative irrationality of the regime, you know, which is the problem, because I think through their behavior they've demonstrated that they are, you know, quite rational and able to gauge red lines and limits. And plus, you know, there's a fundamental principle of the Ayatollah Khomeini, propagated and has which remained a principle of foreign policy making ever since, which is state interest trumps religious ideology. And that he said before he died that the state can suspend the five pillars of Islamic observance and destroy a mosque if state interest required it. And if you actually look at their behavior, it bears this out. So I'm not worried about, you know, like Patrick said, mad mullahs or, you know, this is a martyrdom seeking nation and the like. I think those they try to encourage this perception, but that's part of their deterrent capability, their own deterrent capability. But I think the main problems are regime factionalism, which often leads to policy zigzags and makes for the creating a stable deterrent relationship potentially problematic. The possibility that after acquiring nuclear weapons, they will pursue a more activist foreign policy, which will cause them to engage in greater risk-taking, which raises the potential for miscalculation and getting in a crisis or a conflict with a neighbor or the U.S. And then it involves two nuclear countries, and there's always the potential or escalation and the like. And then finally, the possibility of instability in Iran eventually leading to loss of control of the stockpile. And then we mentioned before, you know, there's a particular problem in Iran that the Rev Guard is believed to be both the custodian of the special weapons programs, which would presumably include nuclear weapons, as well as they're the main one of the main arms of government involved in supporting terrorist organizations. And that's a potentially dangerous combination there. With regard to the forensic problem, the issue, look, and I think all there has to be is a certain degree of ambiguity or questions in the minds of Iranian decision makers that the United States might succeed in attributing or finding Iranian fingerprints as in the isotopic products of a nuclear blast, which will then enable us to successfully attribute this. And the question for an Iranian decision maker then is, how lucky do you feel today? I think the question is, you know, not that we've refined the science so much that there's a degree of certainty, but just the fact that there is a chance that we might be able to nail them, if God forbid they were ever to do this, I think provides reason for at least, I won't say reassurance, but that's I think from a policy point of view the minimum you need in order for the post-attribution forensic capability to hopefully work.
Testing. My name is Bob McNally with Tudor Investment, and I very much appreciated the paper and this presentation. I have a question, I think, more from Michael, but anyone is welcome to join in. Getting to the fundamental requirement for targeting intelligence. As a general matter, can anything be said about the likelihood or the quality of targeting intelligence given different stages of the nuclear fuel cycle, i.e. before they achieve technological capability, breakout, and so forth? Is there anything that can be said about the likelihood that the quality of target intelligence is going to be better or higher or lower for any given stage in the path to a nuclear weapon? And then secondly, I suppose based on the open source and what you see with Iran, how likely is it we may arrive at a point where the politically optimal context for a strike arrives differently than the targeting intelligence tells us is the time to go? Thank you.
On the first question, I mean, I think one of the main questions is there a clandestine parallel program that we don't know about? Therefore, that, you know, we bomb what we know, and then perhaps you don't even impose any delays because there's a parallel program, which is maybe it's at the same level of maturity, maybe it's not, but, you know, maybe in the end you don't have much of an effect, so you've incurred great risk for little or no reward. And you know, that's like, you know, to quote Rumsfeld, you won't hear me saying this often, but you don't know what you don't know. So that's the first order problem. There's also the issue of that if they are producing low-enriched uranium from the declared program, what is now the declared program, previously clandestine or presumably clandestine, are they producing that to be used to feed into a clandestine program or to be enriched to high enriched level at a later date at the declared program in a crisis, and that stuff, once it's produced, could be dispersed, and they could have very large stockpiles. Same thing with the uranium hexafluoride feedstock for the enrichment process. So there are various aspects. I mean, it could be the entire fuel cycle. There could be an entire fuel cycle we don't know about, or there could be aspects of the fuel cycle that are very hard to reach once it reaches a certain stage. That is, like I said, low enriched uranium, which is then kept for use as feedstock, either at overt or clandestine facilities at some later date. The second half, please remind me, what was the second half of the question?
I guess this does get to...
Oh, the timing.
Timing.
I traditionally have broken this down into three areas. There's, first of all, what, in fact, does the timing have on the intelligence picture? Is it getting better with the passage of time, or is it getting worse with the passage of time? And maybe your knowledge of a particular facility is getting better with the passage of time, but your knowledge about other aspects of the program is getting worse. So that's one... issue. And then it's the other issue, the other aspect of that is how important is open source information, for instance, from the IAEA, to your overall picture. And we know that since February of 2006, the IAEA has been restricted once Iran rescinded their adherence to the additional protocol. And they even in their open source reporting said, our picture is, degraded in quality since then. Then there's the issue of facilities with regard to timing. Now, there are some facilities that are, for instance, the hexafluoride production facility, the conversion plant at Esfahan, is fully built. It's a mature facility which has been, pumping out UF6 for a couple of years now, I think. Natanz is at an earlier stage of maturity, and still this is a facility which apparently they have the goal of installing 50,000 centrifuges right now. They have 3,000 working, and they're working on their second 18 cascade. My mind's blocked here, but they've got about 3,000 plus of the 50,000. They tend to put in there, but you're getting to the stage though where they're getting enough centrifuges in there that it's becoming a viable target. But for instance, the heavy water reactor in Iraq is still in the early phases of its construction. That's why you have any kind of policy prevention has to be able to hit multiple times, because they're on a different timeline, and you might flatten one plant, but then there's another plant that is still in its, you have to revisit later on once it becomes mature. And then finally, there's the people in the program. And let's remember that in Iraq, after Iraq's entire, WMD infrastructure more or less had been eviscerated by UNSCOM and by the Iraqis, everybody kept saying, but they still have the know-how. They still have the know-how. So that's the final component. And with regard to the know-how, my assumption is, look, we have limited ability to affect this. The sooner you disrupt this process of learning, the better. But how do you do it? Because the longer it goes on, the more people share the knowledge, and the greater the possibility of a Iranian AQ Khan emerges, maybe, and helps and spreads the knowledge beyond Iran's border. So that. You got to disrupt at the earliest possible date. So there's all different timelines all over the place, and it makes this. That's why, in part, this is so complicated, such a complicated problem.
If I may say a word about the intelligence need for targeting, the most difficult intelligence challenge about targeting, I think, is knowing what is the intelligence about what is Iran's center of gravity. What is it that in fact would lead Iran to change its policies? And there are many people assume that the answer is the destruction of the nuclear facilities is what would lead Iran to change its policy about the nuclear matters, and you can make a good argument for that. But let me just point out that we are talking about a country whose economy is extraordinarily dependent, upon the export of one product, and 80% of those exports go through one pumping station. Now, I would think that constitutes a vulnerability. When this is providing 70% of government revenues and 90% of foreign exchange income. So I don't know what's Iran's center of gravity. But I don't think that it's transparently and obvious and beyond all doubt that it is the nuclear facilities.
And I don't think you were talking about the pistachio export silo. Thank you very much for joining us here today.